Welcome to The Pestle, reviewing and breaking down movies to look for insights into the movie-making process. Hosted by Time Travel. How come people can travel through time but not teleport? The Earth is moving, you know, so you have to, like, travel through time and relocate to a different part of the solar system. Anyway, it's a whole thing. Let's dim the lights and start the show.
Welcome, everybody, to The Pestle. Today's show is brought to you by Lou's Aerobic Fitness Center. Work off that milkshake with a little jazzercising at Lou's Aerobic Fitness Center. Welcome, everyone, to The Pestle. I am Wes.
And I am Todd.
And we're filmmakers. We make things and then watch movies to see how they make things and then what we can learn about all the making of things. Making things is fun, but it's a never-ending process of learning and education. Obviously, you never arrive. Like, if I can listen to Scorsese at the end of his career say, I'm only just now learning what films can be. I need more time. You know, this attitude of he's just still figuring it out. Like, this guy made Mean Streets and Taxi Driver and Wolf of Wall Street. Like, is there something he doesn't know about filmmaking? I don't think so. But to him, it's a never-ending process. And so how much, you know, more can we all, you know, peons keep growing in whatever we're trying to do, whatever we're trying to learn and be better at? It's an attitude of humility. And it's good. It's good to remind yourself that there's still a lot left to learn and grow. I did a shoot last week that I was like, man, I didn't have enough time to execute some of the things I wanted to do. And I just didn't do what I felt was a great job of getting to close enough. Like, if I could have gotten to 95% of what I was trying to do, I would have been okay. But I felt like I got to like 70% of what I was trying to do. And I had hardly any time at all to get everything in place with something. If you're familiar with high key lighting, like, you need a lot of light to do a nice high key lighting. And I just couldn't put it together fast enough with walking into a location blind, not knowing what I was dealing with and having 20 minutes to set up. I was just like, you know what? I need more tools in my tool bag. And so I went online and was looking for workshops, good ones. I've taken some around town and I haven't been super impressed with any of the local Austin workshops. Maybe I just haven't seen them all. Quite possible. I'll still be looking. But I found one that was like, you know what? I'm going to travel out of state, you know, to the corner of the states and, you know, go see what I can learn from this gaffer. Like, that's my weakest point, is gaffing and gripping. I just don't know how to rig a lot of things. Even though I know what I want, I don't know how to do it all the time. Or at least in a safe way, which is, you know, half of good gripping is knowing how to not kill anybody with your light, which is a pro. That goes in the pros list. Yeah, but it's going to cost thousands of dollars. You know, I'm investing in myself. It's money that, oh, you know, instead of that, I could just go make a short film. I could spend all that, you know, $5,000 between travel, lodging, and the workshop. I could just turn that around and spend it on a new short film. I just dropped like 10, 15 on my last short film. It would be easy to do another one, just smaller in scale and give you more for your reel. And instead, I'm investing that so that I can do more in the future and push my career further. It's a long-term game plan, and it's about rounding out your skills and growing, hopefully leaps and bounds. You know, you're always looking for ways to grow in, not just in your career, but if you find yourself passionate about something, but you're no longer willing to grow in it, whether that's, you know, through time or effort or money, you're probably gonna get stagnant. And stagnancy, you know, it's like a shark, as Annie Hall once said. If it's not moving, it's dead. And what we have on our hands right now is a dead shark. and so, yeah. And it was funny because we were talking about this before rolling, and you said something that really impressed me as well.
And oh, go. Oh, yeah. I was like, it, now? Okay.
Sorry.
Well, you were telling me that yeah, your plan is like you're going to Maine for this workshop. And I instantly was like, that's freaking awesome. Someone who I think knows so much about what you do, has been doing it for so long, is not only like looking for outside help, but looking in places that are, I guess, unexpected, right? And in like looking for like the best someplace and investing in yourself. I thought that was so super cool. And then it just made me think, because you know, I've been playing guitar for going on 30 years almost, and which is crazy. I can't even believe it. But I'm not a very good guitar player, because at some point I got frustrated when I was learning guitar, and I just started writing songs, and so I became a singer and a songwriter, and that's where I got my joy, and it's still where I get my joy. However, it was to the detriment of me learning the instrument in a way where I feel free actually playing it. I can sit down mm-hmm. and noodle around, I guess, in my room, and I can play with guys, you know, if they tell me what key things are in and stuff, I can kind of figure it out, but it takes me a while. I'm not fluid. And that's always been, I mean, I'm going to use the word frustrating, but really the word is somewhat embarrassing to me, because at some point, it's not enough to just be able to play guitar. You have to, you know, when you grow up, you need to be better at things, right? Because then you're going to be playing with people that are better. And I had this feeling when I moved to LA and I was playing with really monster cats, and they were just so good at their instruments, and I was just trying to keep up. And so I'm looking at getting lessons, and I'm looking at, you know, buying, you know, packages to learn more and stuff. And I've been doing it for a few weeks now only, but I'm seeing a difference. You know, I'll sit down at the guitar and I'll actually like, oh yeah, I can do something that I see it in a different way. And it's just really cool. So I'm super proud of you for doing that, man.
Thanks, man. It's nice. It's nice to feel like, you know, you're going to get on set or on campus with not just someone who's good at it, but who's the best in their field. And yes, you're going to learn from that person. Not that you can't learn from someone who, whatever, they just walked on set, you know, last week. You might learn something from them. Probably not much, if anything at all, but there's people who have been around that can still teach you a lot. Like I was watching someone gaff on my last short film, and they did some things that I never would have thought of. The way they hid some of the equipment in frame was just like, oh, well, that was genius. And so a lot of it is, you know, just getting more reps in for sure, but being willing to just step outside your comfort zone. Because I don't know if you said this on air or off air, but you're like, you know, there's a lot of great YouTube videos and you're going to learn so much from those. But there's a ceiling on that stuff if you're not able to go talk to other people and I don't know. I feel like every once in a while, you know, I still kind of YouTube around looking for interesting tidbits here and there. Most of them are recycling each other's stuff.
It's great, like, point. Yeah.
They're not really bringing any of their real world wisdom to you. You know, it's just them recycling other YouTubers' advice and hacks, you know, and quick tips and, you know, the most important thing you can do for whatever, cinematography. It's like, oh my God, you know, this is the same thing on probably 40 other, you know, YouTubers. And there are some, oh my God, I won't jump on my high horse here too much though, but I've just seen some YouTubers where I'm like, you shouldn't be teaching. You don't know anything of what you're doing right now. That they rent whatever technical gear and just kind of let the gear stand in for knowledge. And it's just like, you rented a really nice location and you're acting like you know anything about cinematography. That's terrible. And then you're charging, and this is the hard part. It's not that, okay, you know what, you want to whatever set up a YouTube channel and talk about cinema, cool, I get that, but what I don't get is then charging outrageous amounts for your own workshops when you don't even know what your shutter speed is doing to, you know, your frame. Like I've literally seen people advising setting your exposure around, just, you know, set your set, you know, oh, close your shutter speed to, you know, 1/25th of a frame and, you know, you're good. And I was just like, what are you, this is chopping up your image. Like, it's just outrageous. And they're charging thousands of dollars for their quote unquote expertise without fundamental basic shit, you know, that they know. So you do have to be careful who you're learning from, to some degree. And then no matter who you're learning from, I think you should take it with a grain of salt, you know, pro or not, you know, you should keep your head on your shoulders, because whatever, stuff progresses. Just because someone's been an expert in their field doesn't mean that's the way things are still being done, or there isn't other ways to do them. I'm just always cautious about dogmatism. And so, you know, keep your head on the shoulders, learn, listen, shut your mouth, and see, okay, what's the good and the bad? What can I take away from this? What can I apply? But always be open to it. Like, always be open to learning more. And I am, and I want this to be a really big year of, just growth and, you know, putting myself out there even more, and we'll see how it goes, man. Maybe I'll be better at the end of this year than I was at the start. Isn't that the goal?
That's the goal. Yeah. Well, I'm proud of you, man. That's awesome. I can't wait to hear what it's like. It's in July, right?
It's in July. Yeah. Mid-July. So whenever, if we end up skipping a week, you'll know why.
Nice.
But nice. Regardless, like, you know, beginning of the year, end of the year, you're always in this loop of self-improvement. And Todd, speaking of loops.
Oh, look at you, bro. Pew, pew, pew. Yeah. So speaking of loops, today we are covering Back to the Future, the original from 1985. So if you haven't seen this film, please pause this episode, go watch it, because we're going to spoil a bunch of stuff. And honestly, if you haven't seen Back to the Future, I question your humanity. So, yeah.
Correct. Yeah, we'll look at so many things. Cinematography, performance and editing, and those kind of all tie together, as well as story and writing, cars, clocks and loops, as well as Marty's arc, and other such stuff and things and stuff.
And a quick synopsis of the film. Marty McFly, a 17-year-old high school student, is accidentally sent 30 years into the past in a time-traveling DeLorean invented by his close friend, the maverick scientist Doc Brown. It's directed by Robert Zemeckis, written by Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale, cinematography by Dean Cundey, featuring Michael J. Fox as Marty McFly, Christopher Lloyd as Doc Brown, Leah Thompson as Lorraine, Crispin Glover as George McFly, and Tom Wilson as Biff Tannen.
Hey, Doc, this is it.
Never mind that. Why, that's me. Look at me. I'm an old man.
I'm Dr. Emmett Brown. I'm standing here on the parking lot.
Thank God I still got my hair. But what on earth is this thing I'm wearing?
Wow, this is a radiation suit.
Radiation suit? Of course. Because of all the fallout from the atomic wars. This is truly amazing. A portable television studio. No wonder your president has to be an actor. He's got to look good on television.
Whoa, this is it. This is the part coming up, guy.
No. This sucker's electrical. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
What did I just say?
The flux capacitor stores... This sucker's electrical. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
1.21 gigawatts! 1.21 gigawatts!
What the hell is a gigawatt?
How could I have been so careless? 1.21 gigawatts? Tom, how am I going to generate that kind of power? It can't be done, can it?
Look, all we need is a little plutonium.
Oh, I'm sure that in 1985, plutonium is available in every corner drugstore, but in 1955, it's a little hard to come by. Marty, I'm sorry, but I'm afraid you're stuck here.
Whoa, Doc, stuck here. I can't be stuck here. I got a life in 1985. I got a girl.
Is she pretty?
She's beautiful. She's crazy about me. Look at this. Look what you wrote here, Doc. I mean, that says it all. Doc, you're my only hope.
Marty, I'm sorry, but the only power source capable of generating 1.21 gigawatts of electricity is a bolt of lightning.
What'd you say?
A bolt of lightning. Unfortunately, you never know when or where it's ever going to strike.
We do now.
It So, dude, how so many questions? Does it hold up? To what extent, if it does, is that in relation to nostalgia? And what do you think about it, man?
It 1,000% holds up, man. This film is one of my favorite films of all time. I could watch it right now again. And actually, I'm going to watch it today with Simon because he was upset that he didn't get to watch it with me because we've watched it before. Simon, for those of you who don't know, Simon's my 11-year-old son. Anyway, and he loves time travel stuff, just loves it. So, yes, for so many reasons, my God. The way that they tell this story, the way that they set everything up is so awesome and for so many reasons. You know, we establish early on about the clock tower getting struck by lightning. And it's pretty aggressive moment in the film. So you kind of like where they give you exposition 30 years ago, this clock tower, you know, by that lady. And that's fine. And it's a little annoying to us, but it's annoying to Marty and his girlfriend too, and Jennifer too. He's like, here's a quarter, go away, you know, kind of thing. So they acknowledge that. It's just brilliant. Yeah. And in that scene, while Marty and Jennifer are talking, you see the clock tower in the background. Like this is a perfect example of why like Spielberg is so good in his heyday. Just the blocking and the setup at
Zemeckis.
Sorry, what?
Robert Zemeckis.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't know why I said that. It feels like a Spielberg.
Yeah, why did I say that? But the blocking and the setup is so good in this film. You know, so that's just one example. Having a clock tower in the background of them talking, sitting on that bench is just brilliant. Why not? That it's like foreshadowing almost. Later on, they do things like when Marty gets home and the car is wrecked and Biff is there and he's picking on his dad. And everything, they do this move that's so cool. It's a single shot where Biff is like messing with his dad and giving him a hard time. What's that in your shoe, McFly? Shh, don't be so gullible, McFly. And then he walks into the kitchen. This is all one move. The camera pans. We walk into the kitchen. He grabs a beer and he's messing with Marty. You know, and he's like, what are you looking at, butthead? And then he leaves to reveal Marty's dad in the background, who then walks into frame. Things like that, where you're using the action, not a cut. You're using the action to increase like a sense of awareness of the space within that scene is just so good. And they do that all the time throughout the whole movie. They do little things like the lost or the Twin Pines thing, which I never noticed before this viewing, honestly. And what that is just really quickly, what that is when Marty meets Doc at 1:15 in the morning at the mall is called Twin Pines Mall. When he goes back in time and runs into that barn and then, you know, that has the altercation with the guy, with the pine farmer who shoots at him. And then he frantically drives away off the guy's lot. There are two baby pine trees and he runs over one of them. And the guy is yelling, you killed my pine, you killed my, and he's shooting at him. And then later on, when Marty comes back to 1985, the mall is called Lone Pine Mall. That's not necessary, and yet awesome. Yeah. You know, and they do that all over the film. Were you going to say something?
I mean, it's so funny. Like in the past week, since we said that we were going to do this episode, Back to the Future is everywhere all the time. It is omnipresent in our culture, probably in a lot of other cultures as well. Like I've run into it minimum 3 times, 2 separate Reddit threads where people are like, well, you got to remember in Back to the Future, XYZ happened. And a lot of it, that was just about storytelling. And then a friend sent me a clip randomly of Michael J. Fox playing Johnny B. Goode on stage. And it's everywhere all the time. And the number of times I've seen people send me clips of things that we didn't notice, like one of them is the Twin Pines thing. I've seen, the only reason I've ever noticed that is because someone pointed it out to me. And I can't tell you how many times I watched this as a kid, many, and not since then. But And it's absolutely filled with those little loops of, we can see the future changing, and it's almost like we're setting a precedent of the future isn't set in stone, which to me, and I would love to hear your perspective on this. That's part of the thing with this movie, is it's not about the science fiction being grounded. It's about what the science fiction allows you to engage with on a more emotional level, and a thematic level of the future isn't written in stone. You can change it. Even though that probably doesn't square with anything Stephen Hawking had to say, right? For us, those elements of science fiction aren't important, because science fiction does a wonderful job in so many ways. One, it could be imagining a cooler future, literally like Star Trek, right? Or it could just be a way to create some kind of analogy for life, whether that's contemporary times and how they're being reflected in some other scientific or sci-fi setting to allow you to talk about racism or something like that. Or in this case, to talk about, I don't know, how kids impact your life. Like, I was curious if you were going to watch this movie with the lens of being a father and what that meant to you, because Marty changes his parents' life, you know, for the better. Marty never changes in this movie. He has no arc, and I'll talk about that later, but like, he has no arc. He's the same guy from the beginning of the movie to the end of the movie. He changes everything around him, though. So yeah, that was my own little like jump in, like, yeah, the Twin Pines thing is really cool. And there are so many that I will never notice. Like, the one that I did notice was Lou's cafe in the middle of the movie, right in the 50s, I'm guessing becomes Lou's aerobic fitness center. And it's kind of this joke of Lou went from gaining weight, you know, to losing weight, something like that. I don't know. There's so many. I mean, another little, it's a sillier loop, is Marty with the skateboard. Like, Marty takes these kids' skateboard, rips off the little fixing, and he says, "I'll get it back to you," right? And basically goes on a loop around the block and then returns it. Like, that's a loop. And it's silly. It's fun. They talk about reruns. Like, this is brand new. I saw it on a rerun. What's a rerun? And reruns are a kind of loop, right? Except those loops don't change. I don't know. This movie has a lot to say about loops and that kind of thing. But yeah, no idea where that was going.
No, I mean, because you could watch this 10 times, 20 times and find something new in it every time. And that's one of the reasons why I love time travel movies. It gets me every single time. It's so inspiring, the different ways that people think to look at time travel and just assuming it's possible, what could happen, right? I mean, you know, look at Avengers, look at that Back to the Future, there's just so many that have different viewpoint of what could happen. And this, like, I think I love the fact that you called out, like, this is a super inspiring film because it does kind of make it feel like you have control over your future. Like, it's not pre-planned and your decision now can change who and how you are 30 years from now. And it could be something as small as standing up for yourself in a single moment. And all of a sudden, everything is different. He didn't, in the real, if you want to call it, his dad in the real history, didn't have an opportunity or never took the opportunity to stand up for himself, especially in front of Lorraine. It just so happened that he got hit by her dad's car. Okay. And that's how they meet. And he was in a helpless situation that puts him in a helpless situation where she has to take care of him. So for the rest of his life, he's not only is he being taken care of her, being taken care of by her, but he never takes care of himself in relation to Biff. And so what Marty does is he gives him that opportunity to stand up to him, to Biff. And he gives him the knowledge that, like, you'll be okay. You just have to do this, and inspires him. And I think that is also inspiring to us. Like, we need that one person. All you need is one person saying, you've got this. You just need to do it. If you do it, you will be a different person on the other side. I promise. But if you don't have that person saying that, it's so hard to take that leap for many people. I'm including myself in that. And that could be something as small as quitting your job, like what you did 14 years ago, or whatever. It could be something as small as driving over a bridge that you're scared to drive over. It could be, you know, punching a bully, whatever. But having that one person, and Marty is that person. But it's such a good point that you make that he doesn't have an arc. I think that that's important that he doesn't have an arc, because the arc is everything else. So yes, I'm invested and want him to make it back. But I also don't need to see him growing and learning. I need to see the things changing around him. Because if I'm watching him, I'm not watching all the other things changing that he's changing around him. So I think it's brilliant that he doesn't have an arc, that he's the same. What is he going to learn? Honestly, right. How is he going to grow? Like, oh, so now I know time travel is possible. Okay, that's his arc. Now he knows that it's possible, right? I mean, he establishes himself early on too, of like, I'm going to stand up for myself. You know, I'm not a pushover. I mean, the altercation that he has at his high school, he even stands up to the principal a little bit, you know, and the principal, mm-hmm. you're a slacker. And he's like, I don't know. I forget what he says, but he basically stands up to the principal, like, leave me alone, essentially. Anyway, he establishes himself early of like, I don't really know where this guy's going to go. Cause he's already like, he already stands up for himself. He already has respect for himself and everything. And he has to, because he has to give that to his dad. You know, we can't have a weak guy who needs to learn a bunch going back to train his dad to be a stronger guy. He already has to be strong. And we established that right at the beginning. That's just one of the things.
Yeah, that's just one of the things. And I wonder if that was part of the appeal for us as kids watching this, was this is an empowered teenager who's changing his parents. He's also getting to know his parents on a different level, right? His mom is a hypocrite. She's over here saying, I would never do those things that you're trying to do. And he goes back in time like, yeah, she's sitting with boys in parked cars. She's drinking and smoking. And kids never change. Kids are still going to be kids. As much as we like to think, this new generation coming up is this, this, and that. You can literally go back thousands of years and find Greeks literally saying the same thing about their kids. I think it's the Republic. Plato is saying kids these days, they don't want to work. Like, it's outrageous. Oh, yeah. Like, this is ever present through all of culture, through humanity. We go through these phases in our life of, we rebel, and then we create our own culture that is slightly different from our parents' culture, and in a lot of ways are the exact same as our parents' culture. But we're now taking ownership, and now we've learned, and now we know, like, that's all. And as kids watching this, this kid who's going back, and he's showing his dad, like, how to stand up for himself, right? He demonstrates it first. And beating Biff, right? He grabs him in the cafeteria whenever he sees him being aggressive with his mom. And I love every time he gets bold, he sees how big Biff is, and his eyes just go wide like, sir.
That's for us. That's for us.
That's for
Remind
us,
yes. That Biff is a big dude. Yeah.
Big guy. And yet he persists. And then he clocks him in the cafe, and then runs. He's like, I'm not dumb. I'm going to stand up for myself, but I'm not going to get slaughtered in the process. Like, and his dad is watching this the whole time. And it's not until the end when Marty can't interject. He's not in his ear. He just has to do it for himself. There's no one that's going to help George in that moment except George. He has to do it for himself. And that's a wonderful message too, to just say he has to have his own inner voice and his own confidence that allows him. And that's the only moment Lorraine is able to finally see him for a man. And you could say there's some traditional gender roles, stuff happening here. And that's probably true. That's probably accurate. But it I think it's limiting to just say that that's all it's about. And instead giving, you know, George a moment of empowerment and how it's going to influence his family and help him in his life and his own son, his kids, right? Not just the one son, but he has two other kids that are slowly disappearing just because he can't stand up for himself. Yeah. It's God, there is so much going on in this film.
And oh yeah, go ahead.
Please. No, I got like a 30-minute rant coming up, so go for it.
No, you're good. You're good. Also interesting, and I know you know this, Michael J. Fox was not originally cast in this role. It was Eric Stoltz who was cast in this role, and I think they did about 6 or 7 weeks of filming with him before they made the call of like, this isn't working, this isn't right. And it was like a mutual thing. Eric thought the same thing, at least that's what, you kind of see. But one interesting thing that I read when I was doing some research for this, because I don't always go down rabbit holes when we're doing a
but
film.
But this is a one big felt, one.
This is a big one. It felt fun. So Eric was playing Marty McFly, right? At first for 6 weeks or whatever. And then, you know, he left and it was recast. And then later on, I think he was in The Fly, the film The Fly, wasn't he?
Eric Stoltz was in The Fly with Jeff Goldblum?
Yeah, I think holy so. I need to see. And
maybe
he was
The Fly too.
Yeah, something like that. And I think his name in that was Martin. So then he became Martin the Fly or something. I don't know. I saw some kind of like rant about that.
His
I
name
need to,
is Martin.
I need to
it's
go do
Fly
some
two.
Research about it again. But
it's The Fly 2. And yeah, he plays Martin.
Martin. The Fly. And I just thought, oh, that's hilarious and awesome. But no, the cool thing about about this is that when you're making a film, you're trying to do the best thing that you can. And I just want to call out that like films, not all films work. I get that. But, you know, shooting a film like this and then being 6 weeks in and deciding, you know what, this doesn't work and recasting, not only does that cost money, I think it cost them like $3 million in 1985 to do this because they had to go reshoot everything too. But it so much time, you know, and calling when a mistake is made and knowing when to cut your losses is sometimes the best thing to do. And this is a great example of, oh my God, could you imagine Michael J. Fox not being Marty McFly? Can you imagine that? No, of course not. But it was a reality at one point. And somebody had to make the call. This is not working. We have to stop and start over. 6 weeks into shooting. That's a month and a half of work that you just throw down the drain, essentially. Now it's become like cinematic lore, right? Of like, here's an example of somebody making a film and doing it right. Like, look, we want to do this in the right way. And then there were only between when they finished the film and when the film came out, there was only 9 weeks between them finishing the movie and the movie being released. It was only 9 weeks. That's crazy. We finish movies now and like maybe a year later, sometimes it comes out. It was 9 weeks, you know? And another cool thing is that it came out, I think in like a February or March or something in 1985. But this is set in October of 1985. Can you imagine going to see it in a theater and knowing that year this is supposed to happen? How cool would that have been, you know? Oh, I was only 5, so I didn't see it, but
yeah, same. I would have been 4, so yeah. That's a good point too. Like I wonder how old I was when I actually did get to see this. But dude, in the 80s, lighting was different. One of the things that I just find humorous is like the lighting isn't super slick. Like if Deakins had shot this, wildly different feel. You know, they had these big bright lights and they're all up in their faces. There's one shot that I was like, wow, where it's the scene right before Marty goes into George's room as Darth Vader from Vulcan. And it's where George is like, no one on this plane is going to make me change my mind. He walks inside. As he's walking inside, and this is set towards the end of the day, and I can see why they did it. It's towards the end of the day. There's not a lot of light. And so they had set up some huge light to shoot onto George as he's walking through his yard and up the steps and into the house. and you can just see this huge hard shadow being projected against the wall, the house, as he's walking into it. It's just like, my God, like, that's a lot of light. And normally you might, you know, I don't know what you would do, but not that. Probably a lot of bounce, like you bring in a lot, you know, as much bounce as you can off screen, or just kind of let them walk into shadow and lose, you know, some definition, I guess, or something, or maybe stage some lights on the porch itself. But I just thought it was really funny. I was like, man, you know, whatever it takes, buddy. But it's nice too, because this being, you know, this comedy, it plays. You don't really care about, you know, big bright lights, because you want to see everything. Comedies are always big, bright, and friendly. And so you're not, even today, I say this about it being in the 80s, but I've seen comedies in the last few years do worse, way worse, where they're basically setting up floodlights right next to the camera and shooting a whole scene. And I'm just like, y'all had way more money for this. And you know what? If you're happy, I'm happy. At the end of the day, you're still engaging with the characters because it's funny. You don't expect grounded realism, because half the film, everyone's kind of winking at the camera anyway. Like, how many of these close-ups are for camera, right? Where Doc Brown walks like half an inch from the lens and says, damn, you know, damn. Like, it's just, it's fine. And to your point earlier about long takes and these long tracking shots, like, that's how we open the film. Right, this long opening Rube Goldberg shot of contraptions going off, clocks on clocks, and we get into the coffee's pouring, TV's turning on the news, reporting stolen plutonium, burnt toast is popping up, dog food's pouring into a bowl that hasn't been, you know, emptied in a week, and Marty finally enters, and it's funny because we don't see Marty at first, we see his feet. And his bag, and a skateboard, and he drops the skateboard, and he lightly taps it as he's looking at something. And we track with the skateboard that finally lands on the missing plutonium that we heard about on the news. And it's all motivated. Like, all of that is really nicely motivated. The news turning on is just part of his contraptions. It's not, oh, let me turn on the news and see what's happening. Oh my God, there's missing. Instead, it's all just an opening, interesting tracking shot where we're exploring an inventor's laboratory / house. And it's so beautiful and perfect. And it's also very 80s, because they're hiding Marty up until the point where there's a big face reveal, right? He's plugging in the amps and he's turning everything to 11. The speaker blows and blasts him across the room, and he's covered in debris. And then finally he comes out of the debris. And there's his face. Like, that's very Indiana Jones. That's very Spielbergian to me. But a lot of classic filmmakers do this. If you go back to old Humphrey Bogart films, they're doing it there, where you're just concealing your leading hero until, you know, you've dramatically introduced them. And then there they are. I love it. It's very patient and classic. Yeah. I wouldn't mind seeing more of that.
Did you notice that one of those clocks had somebody hanging off one of the hands?
No, what?
Yes, there's a clock that looks like the clock tower. Yeah, there's a clock that looks like the clock tower, and you've got a guy hanging off one of the hands. I think the minute hand.
That's awesome. Damn it, those guys. They thought of it all, man. They must have been sitting in.
And the reason I said Spielberg earlier is because he did mentor Zemeckis for this film, and he's credited in it. That's why when I saw his name in the credits, and I was like, oh, interesting. So that's, I had it in my head, whatever. But
yeah, there's a handful of these guys that just feel like they were all smoking cigars in rooms together for 20 years, like him, Zemeckis, George Lucas, and just a half dozen, Scorsese. I feel like these guys were all just hanging out all the time. I don't know, maybe Scorsese was too busy in New York or something, but yeah. But the cinematography, I think, plays right into the performance and editing. So, like, the performance is theatrical as hell, right? They're staging blocking around the camera, as you pointed out earlier, right? And only moving the camera when necessary, usually to track the people. And so they walk into a close-up. They walk back, you know, into a two-shot. And it's all adding to the theatrical performances. And it's also adding pacing by reducing edits. And I think that's important because they're saving that editing for when they really want to inject a lot of energy into the film. And so we get to the end of the film, Marty's getting ready to drive towards the clock tower, and suddenly the editing starts picking up speed, like faster editings, and it's building momentum. We're looking at Doc, and he's looking at the cord that got unplugged, and Marty's looking at the keys, and the ignition won't turn, and Doc is looking at the clock tower, and he's thinking, what do I do? And then he's hanging the cord, and Marty's learning how to drive again, and he's pumping the gas, and he's flying, and then he's seeing that the thing isn't plugged in. He's closing his eyes, and he's hoping for the best, and all this rhythm is happening, and it's just faster and faster and faster and faster, shorter cuts until he vanishes. And then it all slows back down again. We can breathe. Everything's going to be okay. It's wonderful editing, and it's built right into the cinematography. Like, we're going to use all these longer takes, but we're going to find a way to make it energy. Energy is going to come through the performances and through allowing the actors to move around the scene. And the camera's going to catch all this in wide and you know, these wider angles that also allows the actors to walk up close to the camera without blocking everything else out. You have a wider angle lens. That means they can move over, you know, a few more inches so that they can get a close up and you can see what's happening behind them at the same time. And so just a lot of wide shots allowing the performances and the cinematography to all kind of play in harmony and give space for the editing to do a lot. And then the performances are very over the top. It's so fun, right? In the beginning, Marty, right? Michael J. Fox is finding interesting physical ways to play the scene without anyone else in the scene, right? He gets up, he answers the phone, and the phone is tethered to, you know, it's got that phone cord, and all this debris is suddenly in stuff in the room, and he's got to yank the phone, and he's like got the phone on the wrong ear, and then he gets to move it to the other ear, and then he's walking around the space, and he's looking at things, and he's pulling the cord, you know, loose from the debris, and he walks a few more steps and he's got to pull it again. It's all very, very physical, and allowing him to perform big, right? He's putting on his pants and now he's falling over. Like, they're finding all these interesting buttons for the scenes that allow you to end the scene. Him leaving the frame, you know, it's comedy. And it also says, this moment is done. Now we can cut to the next moment. And this movie is full of that stuff, right? 1.2 gigawatts. And he storms off. Doc Brown storms off out of the whatever that is, the lab, the garage, and into his house. And then he starts fretting. And he's talking to himself or to Tom. I don't know who the is that Thomas Edison? I can't quite figure out who that photo is. But he's, you know, frustrating and he's talking to himself. And then, you know, he delivers his line, and then suddenly Marty storms in right through the door to deliver his line. It's all timed and synced very perfectly, but Marty wasn't that far behind him. Like, he didn't have that much room to allow Doc to rush in, have a seat, calmly look at this painting, picture. And then it's all through, let's just time this so that everything's very big and theatrical and it'll feel natural because the rhythms are all there in place. It doesn't matter if the timing is literally unbelievable. It feels believable because of the way it's all just choreographed. It's wonderful.
Awesome.
And then of course the parents, right? Lorraine and George, Crispin Glover and Leah Thompson are just so over the top with their posturing and the delivery, right? Lorraine is super doe-eyed and shy, pretending to be shy, right? She's kind of holding back who she really is just to kind of play into the times. And George, you know, Crispin Glover is very loosey-goosey and his hands are big and he talks a lot with his hands and like, get your damn hands off her, you. And he's waggling his finger and then he kind of exaggerates like, what do you think? You know, with his arms spread wide, like, that's so over the top and it's so much fun. This really could be a stage play. And, you know, throughout all of this, it's great editing that plays into all these performances. The sound design. So that moment towards the end, Doc Brown brings Marty in. He's like, sorry, I didn't, you know, it's not perfectly to scale. And sorry, I didn't have time to paint it. And, you know, then Marty's looking at it like, what? Yeah. This is incredible. Like, you did this last night. and, yeah. and you're apologizing for it. It's very funny. And they do that little moment where the car races off the edge, catches fire from the electric shock. And it's great. It spins through the floor and it lands into this pile of rags, catches fire. And he lets out this little yelp, Doc Brown does. And it's just, it's a 1-2-3, right? Boom, boom, boom. You hear the boom of the car hitting the rags, the foom of the fire catching on. And then you cut to Doc Brown, like making his noise. And it's funny. Comedy comes in threes, you know? And this movie is full of threes. I'm sure if you studied it, you'd find threes, you know, every 5 minutes or so. Like it's just constantly 1-2-3, 1-2-3. And it works. It's a big setup and a funny little punchline.
Genius. And man, can I just say, if you ever want to study pacing, dude, this film is, it is a lean, you know, like runtime. Every time I'm in a moment and I'm thinking, oh, how, like, I know that this moment is next. How are we going to get from here to there? Like, you know, not how, but man, it's going to be forever to get to there. And then it's just a cut, right? So for example, just a quick example that I noticed when Marty has his letter he wants to give to, or when Marty is, he's in the street, we see Doc setting up the experiment and the cop comes around. And he's like, what you got here? Oh, no, look at that. It's special equipment. You have a permit for that? Yeah, I do. And you see Marty out in the street with Doc as Doc's coming down the ladder. And you know, and you see him thinking like, how do I tell Doc this, you know, that he's going to die? You immediately cut to him in the diner across the street. You can still see the experiment through the window of Doc out there. So we're not breaking 180. We literally just teleport into the diner with him writing the note to Doc. There is no bullshit. It is just, we're just going to be here now. And you, it's fine. You don't need to show him walking into a diner. You don't need to show him picking up a pen and a piece of paper. It's just, we're in the scenario now. We just cut. It's so efficient.
It's so maddeningly efficient. Like there are moments where you're just like, it really does look like magic at times. The scene in the cafe when Marty meets his dad, George, right? And this, he's kind of bewildered at like, you're my dad. And George is freaked out. Like, what do you want? You know? And before Marty can formulate an answer, right? I didn't write his name down and didn't think I was going to need to reference it. The mayor, Goldie. Goldie walks up and he's like, why do you let those boys pick on you? And what I love about Goldie and the band, right? These are the only black characters in the entire film. And they call all the white guys boy. Like that's such a, that's really satisfying to see a grown black man calling white people boy, because of the times in the '50s, that's not how that would have gone. Right. Like, this is a much healthier, like we're here to have fun. We're not. And they call out some of that stuff right at the end of that little sequence of Goldie hearing Marty say, mayor, I like the sound of that. Like, yeah, I could see myself being mayor. I'd clean this town up. And as he's having his moment, and it's very short, it's very efficient, what we don't see is George has left. And so right as Goldie is finishing his moment about Carruthers, right? Carruthers is like, we're never going to see a black man in charge. And Goldie's like, no. You don't, you just wait and see. I mean, I am going to be somebody. And, at that moment, as we walk back over and we pick up Marty again, Marty's been watching that whole exchange because he's fascinated. He's like, that's our mayor. And he's sweeping floors. And suddenly that's when he realizes George is gone. And so we're able to have these quick little loops that just, that not only are there, but they're helping tell the story, because that is a distraction that allows George to get away, that allows Marty to then give chase. That sets up the whole new scene, because if that wasn't the case, then they would have to find another reason for George to get away and to get out of sight so that Marty could catch up to him and then take his place as the guy getting hit by the car, Lorraine's dad's car. And it's just, it's everything that is built into this film is there for a purpose. And it's almost nearly all there to propel the story forward. Like, they find little moments that still aren't necessarily there to take the story forward, but do help tell the story. But those moments are so fast. It's like 10 seconds. If you can take 10 seconds to whatever, build out the legend, or to help the audience fill in how things happen, like George becoming like this big man on campus. We see that happen through these little 10 second vignettes of he punches, you know, Biff out, and Marty is like watching from a distance, and we see these high school kids come into frame like, who is that? That's George McFly. And then we're out. We can see George becoming a big figure through these little moments of how did he get, because if you don't have those moments and then you arrive in the future, you're left to fill in all those blanks yourself. Whereas if you have all these little moments of like, George, you really took care of Biff, didn't you? Man, you should think about running for class president. And now, and again, that's like a 5 second moment. And if within 20 seconds you can build out the reasoning of how the future unfolds, that's really good use of runtime. Like, that's incredible, incredibly efficient storytelling. Now, other stuff within the story and writing, clocks and cars. There's no shortage of clocks in the film, right? Like, everywhere you're looking. Marty arrives in the future, and he's looking up in, Doc Brown in the phone book. And what happens? His watch goes off. Beep, 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 beep. And that's a tell of, oh, crap. The Carruthers or whoever is walking by, like, what's that? What's that noise? Because I guess they didn't have alarm clocks in 1955, which I think actually tracks. Now, I don't know if it tracks that a guy looking at a DeLorean in 1955 doesn't recognize a car. Like, that's probably stretching it, but it's funny nonetheless, I guess. You can get away with that stuff when it's for humor's sake. But what I find interesting about clocks is 88 miles per hour. Why 88 miles per hour? And my opinion is that's because 8 is the number that you see when all numbers on a clock are illuminated, right? So the 8 contains the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 9, and a 0. Like, all those numbers look like an 8, you know, on a digital clock. And that's pretty cool. That's a neat way to say 88 encompasses all of time. And why not? You got to make it a number anyway. You could have made it 90. You could have made it anything. They chose 88. And I think that's why you choose 88. Not just because it sounds cool, but there's also some other little hidden layer that ties it into time itself. The other thing with clocks is the clock tower in the future in 1985, I guess was technically the present. It doesn't work, right? Whereas in the past, it does work. Now, to me, what's interesting about that is that obviously it's a very good story device. You know, that's a method of giving Marty a way to get back to the future. Cool. But perhaps it's also a nod to how things haven't changed since 1955 for the McFlys. Nothing has changed. Time has been at a standstill. George is still a nobody, and it's, you know, decayed his entire life, and he doesn't even recognize it. He doesn't even care, right? He's happy, right? Literally, he's happy. He's laughing at TV, and his life is, for him, good. And meanwhile, we look around that table at the beginning, and we see how no one else is happy. His wife is miserable, and she's pretending to put on a brave face, like, this is the man I knew I was going to spend the rest of my life with. And she says it in a way that you're like, that sounds like desperation. It doesn't sound like a happy ending. And I think the clock tower kind of plays into that by not having worked since 1955, since that very eventful night. Cars are a really important part of this movie. And it's, I don't necessarily know exactly why, but I think I kind of, my impression is this. If you look at all the ways the cars are operating in the film, Marty, right, hitches a ride to school on cars while he's stuck on a skateboard, right? Biff wrecks George's car in the beginning, and Marty was relying on that thing for his big date, right? That's his future wife. He's going to get married and have kids with her is what we find out at the end. And now he can't. He can't go there. He can't get his own future because his car isn't working, right? The Libyans, their van won't start. They're having problems. They can't accomplish their goals because their car won't start. And I find it funny, Libyans. That's clearly a stand-in for the Iranians. Just a few years before this was the big Iranian hostage crisis. And so they're using Libyans as a stand-in for Iran, which, yeah, whatever, fine. They're being silly about it. And so, you know, you have no problem going with it. Marty, though, whenever he finally gets inside a car at the beginning, right, he travels finally to the past. That allows him to change his future and to change his life. Also find it interesting, there's, you know, some product placement going on in this film. Goodyear tires and whatever else, Pepsi. I think that's, I don't want to call it an evil, but it is a necessary aspect of a lot of filmmaking. To get your movie made, sometimes you compromise a little and allow funding to come from sources that lets you make your movie a little bit better. And so, you know what? If Goodyear plays into the story, which it does, and they're going to give you some bucks, which I assume they probably did. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, and also, like, it kind of, like, establishes, like, this is not a foreign, like, we're not on another planet. We're not in another dimension. You know, right. Everybody drinks Pepsi, right? Like, you know, there are Goodyear tires. Like, you know, it just gives in a movie like this, I think it's less annoying and more endearing. You know, in some ways, to have something like that. And yeah, maybe you make some money on it and like it helps you get your movie made. Great. In most movies, I hate that stuff. Like Calvin Klein. Perfect. Right. Come on. That's perfect. Like, I don't care if Calvin Klein gave him $1 million or 2 million. Fine. Whatever. Like, because it pushes the narrative forward of we're still on the same Earth. It's just 30 years ago kind of thing.
It plays. So. Car wise, George, this to me gets into where I think this movie's really going with cars. George was hit by a car in the original past and it gave him a wrecked future, right? It's not until he, George, pulls Biff out of a car and takes control of his life that his life changes and becomes the driver of his own fate, right? Which is reinforced on the dance floor when he takes Lorraine back. And Lorraine herself seems to be, that name Lorraine seems to be a play on DeLorean. You know, that phonetically, there's a lot of overlap going on there, Lorraine, DeLorean. And so I feel like this is all playing into the idea of taking charge of your life as being represented by a car. Marty couldn't get around on his own, right? He had to use other people's cars, in which he couldn't determine the direction. He had to just hope they were going the right direction. And then he has to switch cars because this one's not going where I want it to. And this one is. And so, and then of course, also George improved his life, not by being rewarded for being a perv, right? For being a peeping Tom. And instead it's standing up to a bully who is assaulting a woman. And she's in the passenger, of course. And whenever that's happening, Biff is in the driver's seat. And so I think that's all really interesting and positive things, right? To say that George got Lorraine because he was perving. I don't know if he was perving on her or some other woman on that same street or something, but really nice, you know, story-wise to have a guy who's getting the woman for the right reasons. And discovering that within himself. And of course, Marty towards the end, still the car motifs, Marty gets locked in a car trunk, right? And the keys are in the trunk, right? And that, which is nice that they found a really clever way to get Marty on stage because the guy has to then force the trunk open and cuts his hand. And now they need a guitarist and that's Marty. And again, it's really great, seamless ways to get your actors into position to do fun things. A lot of other movies, to your point about the efficiency, this movie made today would be 2.5 hours long and you would feel it. And you would walk out saying, yeah, that was okay. You wouldn't walk out saying, man, that was amazing. But this being so tightly written and cut, like, really helps you feel the energy and you're getting in and out of moments. Yeah. And they do just such a wonderful job of motivating everything happening in the story. I'll call you tonight at the beginning, right? That clock tower moment. And she hands him the flower and he's like, it's almost wadded up. It's not quite, but he's in the process of getting that thing wadded up and she's leaving. Jennifer is leaving and I'll call you tonight. I'll be at my grandma's. Let me give you the number. Two things happen right there. She has an excuse to give him her number, which gives her an excuse to write on this thing. And then on top of that, so he has the information that he needs. Of course, he's going to keep that. But then on top of that, there's emotional significance because she also added, I love you. Huh. So we as the audience completely believe when he travels back in time, of course, he's still going to have that flyer. Whereas if that little moment doesn't happen, you're almost like, why did he keep that flyer? Oh, yeah, the lady gave it to him and he shoved it in his pocket. That's fine. But him having an excuse to hold on to it and then to show it off, as opposed to, wait, I remember. This woman said the clock tower, look, yeah, see, Doc, the clock tower, you know, is going to get struck tonight. Like, that's clunky. It gets you to your goal, for sure. It's very clunky. And whenever he's talking to Doc Brown, he's like, well, is she pretty? Yeah, she's the best. Look what she wrote. Like, this is something. This means something. Now he's looking at what, at the opposite side. It's just very smart, motivated story so that the plot never feels like a plot. It always feels like it's story. And it's just wonderful.
Like you said earlier, it feels circular. Yeah. Everything. That might be why if you have to pick one reason why this movie like just lasts and it's so loved, I think it probably could come down to just that of everything comes back. It doesn't feel like, even if there are, which there probably are, it can't be perfect, but it feels like everything is circular and always comes back and you get an answer or you get some kind of completion feeling, you know, every gun goes off kind of thing, you know, every loaded gun goes off, and yeah. You know, to quote that. And even the ones you don't expect for that to happen, like the Twin Pines, Lone Pine kind of thing. You don't expect that. It's not necessary. And nobody yells it out at you. If you don't watch closely, you'll never see it, but you probably feel it, you know, because it, you know, like that kind of thing. It's called out as part of the script where he's yelled, you killed my pine. It's part of the script. So when your brain sees Lone Pine later, intrinsically it completes that loop even if you don't realize it, and yeah. That's why it's ingrained in our souls, things like that, you know, like it's just you feel it. So you feel good.
It's so good. And the stakes for Marty are really great because, like we said at the top, Marty doesn't change, right? He's at the beginning blowing out speakers, playing too loud, and then at the end, what is he doing? He's blowing out speakers and playing too loud. Like, he's the same guy. He's literally at the concert on stage. He's kicking the speaker over, right? Which is, you know, the same thing that happened at the beginning where he blows the speaker out. And then everyone's stopping and not enjoying themselves because of him acting like a wild child on stage. He's the exact same guy. There is no arc for Marty. Not to say that there aren't stakes. Of course there are stakes. It's embedded in the film. But it's more than just him getting back to the future. At the beginning of the film, what does he say whenever he's talking to Jennifer? God, I'm beginning to sound like my dad. And then, you know, after he meets Lorraine, what does she say? Or at the end, what does she say to him? You're beginning to sound just like my mother. And that look comes over his eyes. Those are actually hidden stakes. There are stakes for him, maybe not for the audience, but there are stakes for Marty's character, because is that a good thing or a bad thing? He needs to see his parents become something better if he's going to turn out like them. And so for him, he wants to see them do better. It's not just, oh, I just need to get back. You know, of course, that's his number one goal. But in the process, you know, he's finding these ways to get his parents back together, and maybe through accident. Like, I don't know if it's intentional of him trying to get his dad to be a better person. I don't think it is. I think it's just him trying to fix his mistake. And in the process of that, he's teaching his dad how to be a better man. And that's really cool. But by getting to the end of the film and having everything changed around him, we've seen him go through a lot of stakes and having a lot of goals. But what's nice is he gets back to his present. And he's still not done, right? Because he gets back and he still has a goal to save Doc Brown. And that's satisfying to feel like, oh man, we're done here. Oh God, we're not done. Like the hidden third act kind of, you know, pressure is always really nice to have, kind of a double ending of, you know, the first goal isn't really the goal. the real goal is to make sure Doc Brown doesn't die. And that's such a wonderful thing to keep the energy going and to have something else like forcing him to want to get back to the future. It's not just it's my time, but it's my best friend. He's going to die if I don't do something. And it's so good because he gets back and he fails. But Doc is okay anyway because Doc Brown was also willing to change his own future. He went against everything he knows and says, you know what? Maybe the future isn't written for me either. I'm going to change it. That's a really cool, and it's just reinforcing the overall lesson that you can change your future willingly. And Doc Brown is the only one who knows he's changing his future in this whole film intentionally.
And, great point.
And that reinforces, you know, the greater thematic element of the movie of nothing is written in stone. You can always change your future. It's beautiful.
Awesome.
And then Marty gets back home. And reinforce, he hasn't changed. He's treating his parents the exact same. He's not like suddenly like, oh, dad. Instead, he's surprised. Like, oh, my God, mom, you're thin. And what do you mean? Like, the car is wrecked. And he's not playing into the idea that everything could have changed, even though he's seeing everything changed. There's nothing in Marty that's changed, though. So he's kind of assuming nothing else has changed either.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah. Good. I love it, Todd. I don't care what you say.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's a flawless movie. Like, just the way that, you know, it's as good a movie as I've ever seen made for so many reasons. And runtime is one, and just how fast everything happens. So many iconic lines and moments. And yet, as fast as it goes, there are things that are not fully necessary. The playing the Johnny Be Good song, not necessary. Not at all. There's no reason why that has to happen. But it adds something huge, because not only is he changing his own life, right? Or like, you know, resetting, at least while we're watching the film, we're seeing him reset his own life. He's affecting everybody else. Your cousin Marvin Berry, you know, that sound you're looking for, you know, so he's changing the world. So it just makes it even more, you know, his impactful, but it's not fully necessary. You take that out of the movie, it doesn't make the movie worse. It maybe makes it less iconic because now we don't have that Johnny Be Good scene, which is amazing, but it doesn't kill the movie for you, you know? But yeah. They take the time to add in these little things like that, that add, I mean, 3 minutes to the runtime, but, you know, don't really push the narrative like heavily, you know? They don't add stakes or anything like that, but they do, to your point, like establish Marty as the same. So, yeah,
so good. And this, yeah, it was nice coming back to this. I probably haven't watched it since I was a kid. Like it's been just kind of in the background for me for whatever, 20 years more. And coming back to it, was really cool just to see how well it holds up, how much I still love everyone in it. And to kind of rediscover Crispin Glover, he is so weird. Like, he's amazing and hilarious, and just such a kook. Everyone else was exactly the way I remembered them, except Crispin Glover. He was way bigger than I. And it's funny because I quote him all the time. Like, probably once a week, I go up to my roommate and I'm like, get your damn hands off her.
And that's funny because, like, if you're playing a nerd or a dweeb or something, or somebody who doesn't have any self-confidence, you would think that they would be meek and small, but he plays this, like you said earlier, this guy who's just, he can't control his limbs. Essentially. He's just like all over the place. And that's just such a unique way to play a character like this. So just, you know, he can't breathe. It feels like he doesn't know how to do anything, but yeah, he's like large. He has this largeness about him.
It's so cool. Good.
And what about Doc? You know, just so good. Like, you called out the you know, he set fire to the thing and he's like, you know, his reactions to things are just fantastic. Like when he's trying to plug in he's on the clock tower and he's trying to plug it in and then it unplugs down he's like, just his little reactions, and the editing around that is so fantastic too. And then the last thing I want to point out, the brilliance of this is to, that the fuel, the car, that the time machine needs to be fuel from 1985 that is more accessible in 1985, that's not accessible in 1955. Plutonium is perfect. It's just of course plutonium is hard to come by in 1955, but in 85 there have been advancements. Yeah, so that's a perfect fuel. And then at the end, when Trash is the fuel, of course it's fantastic because he goes into the future, and so obviously stuff, you know, it's going to be more efficient. And so what's efficient? Well, everybody has trash. Why not? And it's just a little nugget there. One thing I will throw out that in the research that I did is that they didn't expect to do a second and a third one when they did the first one. And so, and they called out, if we would have known that we were going to make a Back to the Future 2, we wouldn't have put Jennifer in the car.
Oh, I was wondering, because I looked and I was like, is she in the second movie? I don't remember her. Yeah. And she's not.
She is. Oh, she is. She? Well, there is a Jennifer, not the same one. They recast it because she has a role, and they recast it, but they immediately knock her out, you know, in the film.
Damn.
In the film, she's like, she sees herself or something and she passes out, and then they put her on a park bench or on her porch bench at first. And then she like whatever. And so she doesn't have like a large role, but they wouldn't have put her there, you know, if. Yeah.
Oh, so, that hurts.
It's all right. It's all right. It's just they didn't just act like she wasn't in the car in the second one. They, you know, built the world. And I think that was smart. But I just thought that was interesting. You know, they didn't expect to do a second one.
That is funny. I mean, that's such a famous, where we're going, we don't need roads. I mean, there's so much iconic about this film, and you see it referenced all the time. Like movies still, like Ted Lasso just had, an incredible run, and they referenced what a nearly 40-year-old movie. Ronald Reagan, the actor? like it's just all the time, yeah. Everywhere. It's incredible how well, you know, society, our culture really just appreciates and adores this movie. And I think for all the right reasons, not that there's really wrong reasons, but it is wild to think that there's a 30-year gap between 85 and 55. And for us, that's like just time changed altogether. And yet it's been almost 40 years since that movie came out. And we would never think about making a movie, you know, a time travel movie going from 2024 to 1994 and see such a huge difference as we see between the 50s and the 80s. But that's the cool thing about this movie is, and films in general, is I learned so much about the past from watching this movie. Like, even if it's just a couple songs, right? Johnny B. Good, you know, Chuck Berry, Mr. Sandman. You know, it's cool how films can introduce us to eras and other ways of life without really thinking that you're learning about that stuff. It's just a song in the movie, and suddenly that's just a part of my life now. That's cool. Yeah. I dig it.
And last, a quick thing is that one of the reasons why Michael J. Fox wasn't originally cast is because it didn't work out because he was shooting Family Ties, and it was like a conflict. But because they shot for 6 or 7 weeks with the other guy, there was time for them to work it out, and so he ended up. He ended up being able to sign on because of that, but he was still shooting Family Ties at the same time. So he would go from set, Family Ties set, to shoot this movie, and they would do a lot of their shooting. They would do all the night shooting, right? And the day shots were on weekends.
Oh my God.
So he would get like 5 hours of sleep every night. So he'd be working all day, first on Family Ties, then he'd go and do Back to the Future. At night, go home, sleep for 5 hours, go do Family Ties, and then on the weekends, when he wasn't shooting Family Ties, he'd shoot the day scenes of Back to the Future.
That's incredible. I know not exactly how that feels, but I have some idea of how that feels. So I was the stand-in for Jason Voorhees on Friday the 13th, you know, back in 2008, and while shooting that, I was also working full-time, you know, for our company, Demand Media, this media company. And I would work my full-time job. Then because Jason almost always showed up at night, that's when I needed to be on set. And so I would work all day and then go work at night. And I was dang, not quite 24 hours a day, but pretty close, because night shoots are, you know, from probably whatever, if the sun sets at 8, let's say, then you're on set at 7 and you're wrapping at 5 or 6 a.m. and then it's an hour drive back home, and then I got to be up in 2 hours to get back to work. And so I was just constantly taking cat naps throughout the week and then sleep all weekend. But amazing. I also wasn't heavily, I didn't have to learn lines or perform. I would have been cooked. Like, that's incredible that he was doing that. I had no idea. That's the first time I've heard that. That's wild.
Wild, right?
And but, to nail it, he it wasn't like he were getting the second best Michael J. Fox. You were getting the best Michael J. Fox.
The literal best. Yeah. Like, I don't know. I don't know how he did that, but you just got to love what you do, you know?
Yeah.
And he did. I mean, I'm sure it was, they probably, I mean, I guess they shot this nearby, you know, for him or something. Maybe they, I don't know if they changed locations or something. I have no idea, but whatever. I'm just glad it worked out, because now we have Back to the Future.
That's so cool. But it's also, I think, important to note that they knew he was the right fit and they went ahead anyway. And that's not because that's the way big productions work. Like, look, if that was maybe my production, fine, I can wait 2 months. But these bigger sets, they have schedules and they have funding that comes at certain times, and everyone else is being scheduled around that. Your cinematographer, your whatever, your director, and then the studio's got a release date that, like, okay, we're green lighting this. You're going to shoot at this time so that we can release here. And in 1985, to be 9 weeks away from release, like, we do that now. Like, Marvel, I've heard, does, like, sometimes renders the same day of release because they're fixing shots. Like, I've heard crazy stuff about.
I guess I believe that.
Yeah.
Especially now.
But for them to be doing the amount of visual effects that they were doing, I would love to see kind of how that scheduling broke down, because watching it last night, I was like, oh man, I wonder if they shot all those opening sequences at the same time or staggered it so that Michael J. can show up at the end, and we'll reshoot like that van sequence with Doc Brown getting shot, just in case we want to change anything. Like, what if we want to cut his hair in the future? You know, someone has a great idea, you leave some space so that, but if the timeline is that tight, then you almost have to say, no, we are married to all these decisions and we shoot it all right now, because otherwise, you know, we're going to be screwed waiting for some of these visual effects to get finished before shooting. And so let's re-tinker everything so that we shoot anything with an effect first and give ourselves space to let all that run its course. I don't know, but it had to have been just a producer's like greatest nightmare and greatest achievement.
Totally. And there aren't very many visual effects shots in this film too. Yeah, you know, that a lot of it's like practical and real. There's like 30 some odd shots. That's it. And yeah.
And then a flying car. I mean, you know, building that, you know, is probably really fun to make a car fly.
Yeah. Right.
Anyway. I want jetpacks. Nice. Well, that's all I got. What are you going to recommend this week, man?
Yeah, that's all I got. Well, it's not all I got, but we're at runtime.
Yeah, we are at runtime.
So I'm going to recommend another sci-fi film that I recently rewatched again, High Life, with Pattinson. It's really interesting and weird and kind of messed up in a lot of ways, but some really interesting things happen in it. And, you know, I'm just a sucker for anything in space. I'll recommend High Life.
Dude, nicely done. It's funny, like, this story I'm working on right now, like, I was thinking, like, Robert Pattinson would be amazing for this. And so I'm going to build it out and see if I can hit up his agent and see if I can get a little interest.
Do it.
Because if you can, if you can say, hey, I'm talking with financiers for a $5 million budget, we would love to, you know, have you on for this. And then if you get that, then you can certainly get your $5 million. And then if you get that, you can certainly get whatever the cinematographer that you want and the production designer. This would be a heavy production design kind of film. And so I would want to find whatever, someone incredible. Yeah. But it's a funny game of putting a film together that I'm only just starting to learn, and hopefully we'll get a couple victories. Yeah, I was feathering for time. And I think, let me see if this has been, I can't believe this is, I would have swore you recommended this. I'm going to recommend, I think, yeah, why not? A Michael Bay film. It's big, it's fun, it's silly and dramatic. It's Armageddon. You know, I really enjoy it. It's probably my favorite Michael Bay film. And if you haven't seen it, if you're younger and this is a film that passed you by, you know what? Grab some popcorn, get ready for a lot of Aerosmith, and just have a good time. Like, don't take it too seriously, and you will. I think you'll really enjoy it. It's a gorgeous film, and absolutely ridiculous for sure. Yeah. Armageddon. Stay tuned for next week. Does this look okay to you, man? Nice. We're going to maybe take a decade forward and look at Jon Favreau and Vince Vaughn and Doug Liman's Swingers. There's a lot that I really enjoy about that film. I want to see if it still holds up. I have a feeling that it probably will. So stay tuned for that. Swingers from the 90s. And if you're enjoying the show, don't forget, subscribe, leave us a note. If there's something you want us to talk about, kind of things you find interesting, let us know in the comments or in a review. And if you want to comment on this episode in particular, tell us all the loops that we missed. I can only imagine. There's probably websites, right, dedicated to this. I can only imagine. And you can do that at thepestlepodcast.com/backtothefuture.
And our quote of the day is from HG.
No, you know
who is eight? No,
sorry, god dang it.
Thank you. I was like, what are we talking about? That's what I thought. And our quote of the day is from HG Wells: affliction comes to us not to make us sad but sober, not to make us sorry but wise. I couldn't agree more. And a lot of times it's really hard to see that, especially when you're in the moment of experiencing the affliction, of whatever kind of affliction that might be. But we don't grow from success. We grow from failure. We grow from being challenged. And I firmly believe that. And I try to challenge myself a lot. I also love being comfortable. I'm not going to lie. I think we all do, you know, comfort in all the ways, you know, monetarily, physically, of course. But I don't grow from that. And when I'm in those places, I feel it. If I'm in there a little bit, it's fine. But if I'm in that feeling for a long time, I start feeling stagnant and like stuck and stuff. And so I kind of have to shake it up to maybe I'll change my workout, or I'll go harder at it, or maybe I'll learn something, you know, on guitar, or maybe I'll like force myself to write a song when I don't want to, or maybe I'll take a cold shower. And I fully, fully subscribe to this 100%.
Dude, I love that. You know, man, Martin McFly found himself out of time, and Dr. Brown said, "I'm sorry, Marty, I can't send you back forward in time." And you know what? Martin said, "That will not stand. I'm going back." And he did it, Todd. He went back. And you know what? If that's not a lesson for us all, I don't know what else to say.
We just need to go back to the future.
That's all. I love how they say it, the title of the film, like two or three times in the film.
Yes.
Gotta go back, agreed. Marty. Back where not? Back to the future, Marty. Back to the future.
So good. So good. Great quote. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. This is so much fun. I just absolutely adored this. I can't wait to watch it again in about a couple of hours with my son. It's going to be wonderful. I hope you enjoyed it too. If there's a film that you'd like to see us pick apart, please share us. Who knows? Maybe we'll review it. And please subscribe, share us with your friends, all that good stuff. It helps so much. I can't tell you how much it helps. And until next time, I'm Todd.
I'm Wes.
Go watch some movies.